I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
Who's buried in Midian?
Ain't nothing but dead folk.
Somewhere. Hidden from sight, closer than you might think, is a place that's not on any map. Midian. It looks a lot like hell, but they call it home.
There goes the neighborhood.
They're not pretty. They're not neighborly.
Y'all come back now! You hear?
They're not even human. But this time, they're the good guys.
Sounds like we're going head to head with the devil himself.
Out of your deepest fears and your darkest fantasies, Clive Barker brings you a startling new breed of adventure. Nightbreed. At last, the night has a hero.
Outstanding.
Hello and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys. This is a podcast and YouTube channel where two guys get together. We talk about horror movies, science fiction films, key influences on the particular topic of the week, and then things that that topic influenced going forward in time. Well, we've covered movies from almost 100 years ago, so we've got a lot in there. If you like what you see or hear today, we'd love to hear from you down below. How'd you find out about us? What do you think? Are we doing okay? Give us a rating, a review, a little thumbs up, something like that. And if you're returning, hey, glad to have you back with us. My name is David. I'm here with my good friend Tim. And Tim, we're back at it and we're here again.
I know.
Scary time.
It's like, our second episode in 2026? God.
26.
Talk about science fiction.
Yeah. I thought 84 was a long way away.
No. Oh, wow. What have I been doing in my genre week? That's what we usually do to break the ice around here.
We do.
And I decided to go way back and watch a little movie called Cat O'Nine Tales.
Is that Val Lewton? Who is that?
No, it is Dario Argento.
Dario
Argento, I should say.
Argento.
This movie came out in 1971. And
wow.
I thought that I had not seen it. It was on, believe it or not, on Turner Classic Movies. But I remembered it shortly going in. This is a part of his animal trilogy. Remember how he used to do these trilogies that were like loosely connected? And his animal trilogy was some of his earliest films. The Bird with the Crystal Plumage was one. This was another. And Four Flies on Grey Velvet was the third.
Okay.
Not sure about the order they came out. But like I said, I remembered this once I started watching it. So I had seen it, but it has been 40 plus years, which is why I probably forgot. I saw it. I'm probably. Sure I rented it at Video West or something in Morristown in the 80s, ooh, early 80s. Yep. Anyway, probably. It's, as I mentioned, directed by Dario Argento. He is often referred to as the Italian Hitchcock. I would like to say that I appreciate him, but he is not. The cast features James Franciscus, short off of Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Yay!
And a Carl Malden playing Blind. And that's why I remembered it. As soon as I saw him, I went, oh, I've seen this, because Carl Malden's a blind guy in it. The synopsis is, a blind retired journalist teams up with a newspaper reporter hoping to catch a killer connected to a pharmaceutical company's experimental research projects. So if this does not sound like a horror movie, it really isn't. This is what we would call a giallo movie. I have mentioned these before. Okay. They are just kind of a seedy crime murder, very grisly and gory murder-like type movies. It got 81% of Rotten Tomatoes with 21 reviews. You know, when the movie's that old, they don't get as many reviews if it's not popular.
Right.
I have a feeling they gave it an 81 because it's Argento. I don't think it deserves it. It has not aged well. The crazy jazz music in it is very reminiscent of The Night Stalker, which came out, I believe, the same year. We covered that a few seasons back.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. The plot is convoluted. The Italian acting is horrible, but it does have some delicious kills, which you come to expect from Argento. He's really good at that. I like Deep Red and Suspiria more because they're a little more supernatural. This is not, though. This is pure giallo, and that's what I did.
Have you seen Bird with a Crystal Plumage?
Not lately, but I saw it on video when I saw this.
Yeah, I saw it decades and decades ago, but I've never seen this one or the other one you mentioned. So, interesting. Well, that's good. I mean, anytime anybody compares him to Hitchcock, I'm going, well, they said the same thing about Brian De Palma, and that's not true either.
No, so, not at all. No.
I mean, they both try really hard, but I think Hitchcock was very unique in his film vocabulary. It's kind of like saying somebody is Kubrick. Well, no. Kubrick is Kubrick. That's just going
to
be.
But Hitchcock's closer to Kubrick in that they know exactly what they're going to do and how to set it up. Whereas I think a lot they of these wannabes fly by the seat of their pants sometimes.
Yeah. And then maybe have two scenes that they go, I know what this is going to look like because these shots are going to be cool.
Yeah. This murder. You
know, or whatever.
She's going to be decapitated by an elevator.
Yeah. There's going to be steam all around her in the shower and the silhouette's going to come from the back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I didn't watch anything scary. I went back to audiobook world and listened to a new one called The Singularity Trap. I got hooked on it because it must be similar to the way you do a lot of Turner Classics and Shudder and everything, and you're scrolling and you see something, you go, ooh, that sounds interesting. Let me look. Ooh, I think I'll watch it. I don't usually have a lot of sit-down luxury sometimes, but I have a lot of commute, so I can listen a lot more than I can see lately. And I like Dennis Taylor, who's this kind of been a rising science fiction writer in the past decade or so. He did the one I think I mentioned about a couple of months ago, beginning of the season or whatever, called The Bobiverse, which is I Am Legion, I Am Bob, about a sentient spaceship, essentially, was his story. He's got a lot of Heinlein kind of feel to him. And that's what this one definitely reminded me of. But it's a double win for me because I like his style. I like his plotting. This was one of his newer novels. And it was also narrated by that guy who I think is one of the best narrators in the world, named Ray Porter, who's very strong. And the basic premise, you'll see the Heinleinism, is set in the distant future. We have Earth is as it is, sort of thing, and what we imagine the future of Earth being like. So in order to make ends meet, this guy, who really is kind of down on his luck, joins a mining ship to go on an 8-month tour, and they're going to go out to the asteroid belt, they're going to mine around, and they're going to bring back, maybe they'll strike it rich, and they'll all be ultra gajillionaires, or at least he'll make enough on this that he can take care of his wife and his kid back home. He's two kids. And it's all about the whole beginning of the book. The first third is all about he's never been into space before. And it's learning how to be the grunt and the one that everybody picks on and makes the new kid. What's that? Jaffo, just a fucking new guy or whatever that they used to call people. But anyway, they're on one mission one day and they find this very unique smaller asteroid and they go out to look at it. He ends up doing a drill bit on it and seeing something that looks interesting. So he reached down, touches it. The next thing is he wakes up in the infirmary aboard the ship and his hand is aluminum. It looks like Silver Surfer. He even says it looks like Silver Surfer. His hand is silver, but he can still feel it and he can still manipulate it, but it is totally metallic. He can ram it into stuff and everything.
Cool.
And this is spreading.
Oh.
So the rest of the story is, what do you do? This is alien contact, but we're miners. It's like Alien. We're a bunch of miners. We're not used to alien contact. What are you talking about?
You join the X-Men.
What do we do? Yeah. And then what happens? Does it take over his whole body? Does it not? Blah, blah. And then what happens from there? Really cool story that keeps getting better and better as it goes. And it's a standalone story, which I'm glad of. It's not this is book one of a duology that we're doing. Whatever.
Everybody wants series now.
I know. Everybody. And it's well told. It's a great one-off story. It's called The Singularity Trap by Dennis Taylor. And I highly recommend it. I think it was a really good listen or read, as you say.
Well, I have a nice segue for that.
Yeah, you do.
I do, because you said that it is a standalone story. And this story ended up being a standalone story, but it was intended to be a series and much more. And very much like the 1971 movie, which I had high hopes for, I think there were a lot of high hopes for this movie, and it has not aged well at all. It is a little movie called Nightbreed. Before I continue, though, I would like to mention that this is a listener request episode, and the listener is Tyree Morrow. We would like to thank you for recommending this movie.
Yes, definitely.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm not going to trash it too hard because I have a fondness of Clive Barker, and I know what he was trying to do, but I will say that...
And I never trash anything, so we're fine.
Yeah, bullshit.
It'd be great.
Bullshit. Bullshit. Excuse me. Let's see. Quick synopsis. Well, the movie follows a guy named Aaron Boone, played by Craig Sheffer. He's a deeply troubled and haunted man that has vivid nightmares of a place called Midian, which is basically a city of monsters. He has a psychiatrist, a Dr. Philip Decker, played by the filmmaker David Cronenberg, which is kind of interesting casting. Who is a secretly sadistic serial killer with a really cool mask. And he is trying to frame Boone for his crimes. While on the run from the police, Boone is shot but resurrected after falling at the graveyard house, at the graveyard housing a mythical city beneath it. And that is the Midian place that he has been dreaming of, where a race of outcasts of humanity dwell. His girlfriend, who seems almost like an afterthought in this movie to me, discovers the truth and eventually follows him to Midian, where the Nightbreed, which is what the monsters are called, distrust and banish her. Meanwhile, Dr. Decker becomes obsessed with destroying the Nightbreed, manipulating the police and a band of fanatical vigilantes into raiding the creature's hidden city. Midian ends up being destroyed. Decker ends up being killed by Boone, and Boone embraces his destiny as one of the monsters now, and the leader, as he is named by their god, Baphomet, Cabal, which is actually the name of the story that this movie is based on. The movie people wouldn't let Clive call it Cabal. They said that was nothing. They needed a better title, so they came up with Nightbreed. And then the film has a history that we'll get into as far as different cuts, and there's multiple endings. But the one that we saw, I believe, ends with Decker staying dead, but this fanatical priest being transformed and going off to pursue the Nightbreed because Cabal or Boone are leading them to their new home, so to speak. And then there were supposed to be more movies, and there never were. So that's it.
But there aren't more novels, right? This is based on a novel or a short story?
It is based on a novella, very much like The Mist. It was the first story in the sixth book of Blood, the final book of Blood. So it was a book of short stories with a novella in the beginning of it, and that was this story. And it did not have any other continuations. However, they did do comic book spinoffs of it. So it did go in other directions as far as comic books and graphic novels.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you remember about this movie? Because I don't think I was living in Morristown by the time this came out. So we didn't see this together.
We did not see it together. I remember seeing it, but I do not think it was at a theater. I don't think it was either. VHS. And I remember once I watched the whole movie, because I was trying to remember sitting down, getting ready to watch it and prepping, I was going, okay, what do I remember? What was my first encounter? What do I remember about it? And all I could remember was cool monsters, but I don't know why I don't remember anything else, right, really. And then after I watched it, it all came flooding back as far as it's just a very disjointed story. I think this is a great lesson in stick to your medium almost, which is weird because I really like Hellraiser. The first Hellraiser, I think, is a good movie. I think it's well done. I think it's scary. I think it's creepy. I think it's got all the Barker kind of stuff to it. It still has some issues, especially with the ending and with a couple of the pacing things. But overall, a really good movie. This movie doesn't. This movie has some really bad pacing things, some really bad direction. It definitely didn't age well. It definitely falls into that whole late 80s, early 90s aesthetic where everything was really, really overlit and fight scenes became the norm. You have to have more and more fights all the time and everything. And yet all your fights aren't cool. Your fights are basically just throwing people around and throwing them into walls and whatever. They're not cool kills or cool, neat things.
Yeah. Yeah. I read.
And that's kind of my.
One of the things wrong with this movie, this was from an industry person, was that it was too late for animation and too early for CGI. And I was like, yeah, oh, that makes a lot of sense.
I would kind of agree with that. Although I do think the creature design in this is great. Mm-hmm. It reminded me, one of my keys is Guillermo del Toro, mm-hmm. who loves to design these kind of primitive-esque sort of tribal creatures. And that's what these are. It's really some cool designs.
Yeah, and I mean, he's right to do a remake. Guillermo would be great at redoing this movie.
Yeah, I just wish they had done more with it and done more with those creatures and strayed a little bit less with Cabal and or the entire serial killer subplot. We really didn't need it, really, if you wanted to tell the story, because there's no influence that changes it at the end other than you kill him. Okay.
They needed a bad guy, and he wanted the monsters to be good guys. So the only other bad guy would be the cops, I guess.
Well, yeah. Set up your redneck cops the way you do. And this turns into like almost a redneck comedy.
Oh my God. That guy that plays the police chief is so terrible.
He's so bad.
And he's a regular actor. He's still working. He was on shows like NYPD Blue and stuff. I think it was NYPD Blue. He's on one of those big ones. But anyway.
Well, don't give him a lot of lines.
No, but he will chew them up and spit them out.
But we talk a lot when we look at these movies about what's the theme underneath it and what's the impetus for it. Why did they want to make this movie? It's really hard to tell in this movie. But I think Barker likes convoluted or layered storytelling. So I don't mind that. It's just that if this is his story about his transformation into leader of the Cabal or leader of the Nightbreed and accepting that, I'm not sure that comes across very well, that that's his destiny. He's the hesitant hero.
Wow. Kind of thing. As bad as it is, there's definitely some motivation behind this, and you'll see when I get to it. Well, actually, we'll talk about it, but because yeah, it's clear what this movie's about. Before we do that, let's do a little bit of production. Even though Clive wrote and directed this movie, someone was uncredited for the final script. Do you know who that was?
No, I do not.
Mark Frost of Twin Peaks fame. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He
really?
Yeah. He was the screenplay writer. I know, because this screenplay sucks.
Yeah.
That's one of the problems with this movie. Really? Okay, let's keep going in production, and I'll talk about it even further. Music, Danny Elfman. Clive Barker said Danny is an extraordinary talent, and the most uncompromised portion of this entire movie is the score. So it's got great music.
At the beginning. Later on, it's really not good. The whole climax, last half hour music is really weak.
Well, he was trying to make fight music, I guess, and he didn't have Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton. I don't know.
Right.
Which was the movie he had done just prior to this. Because this movie actually was filmed in the 80s, and it was supposed to be released in 89. It didn't come out till 90 because of all the different cuts they did of it.
Okay.
So that's why it doesn't feel like a 90s movie. It feels like an 80s movie. 20th Century Fox drastically cut it at the last minute to its theatrical release, omitting most of the graphic violence and completely deleting rock singer Suzy Quatro's role from the final print.
Wow. Okay.
They misleadingly advertised it as a standard slasher feature because they didn't know what to do with it. So they decided, this is a slasher movie.
Yeah.
Barker was given $11 million to make this movie, which when you compare it to the $2 million he had to make Hellraiser, that's a lot more money. His original version ran 2.5 hours, and Fox asked for almost an hour to be cut, prompting editor Richard Martin to leave the project in protest. Nightbreed was cut to 2 hours and then again to 102 minutes. However, when it was released on February 16th in 1990, it grossed $3.7 million on its opening weekend and went on to make $8.8 million in the United States and $7 million internationally. So it ended up making $16 million. It ended up making money, even though it didn't look like a movie that would make money and it was totally marketed wrong. That's what, to me, the blame of this movie is Clive Barker. I almost want to compare it to Maximum Overdrive. It's like maybe the writer shouldn't direct the movie because
that was one of my keys.
Yeah, he can't. He did a great job with Hellraiser because it's a small movie with a small cast in almost a single location, and it works. This was like him trying to do Cecil B. DeMille of monster movies or whatever. And it's so disjointed. The pacing is very erratic. And like you said, the motivations don't really make a lot of sense.
Agreed.
Yeah. And so that's what I was leading up to. You've got great makeup. You've got great music. But then that doesn't make it a great movie. It's like he was picking, like, get this. He wanted this to look really real and beautiful. So he got the artist from Star Wars to do the backdrops. So you have like Star Wars pedigree on this movie too. So it doesn't matter that you get all these great people. If you're the ringmaster and can't make it all work together, it's still a flop. And it was, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can't either get the vision across. I also think when you have to be really good, I think, to be a writer-director because you, especially if film is not your forte writer-director. In other words, you're a novelist who now wants to direct your own work. Mm-hmm. I think you're undercutting both professions. The writing is going to suffer and the directing is going to suffer unless you're really, really good. At being able
because you're trying
that.
To please and yourself and you're trying to please producers. Yeah.
Right. And are you able to cut your darlings, like you said, or kill your darlings, whatever you say? And are you able to to change the medium so that it gives the feeling that you wrote into how it is visually represented.
Yeah.
And I don't think, and I think King suffered with that horribly with Maximum Overdrive. Mm-hmm. It's very true. And I think it's here. I totally agree with your assessment.
And I think, King was heavily coked up when he made that movie. I don't know if Barker was on anything when he made this movie or not. He has had some serious health problems. Did you watch that thing I sent you? That last
interview? I did not watch it, but what I was going
to. Oh, he looks terrible. But it was not drugs. It was sepsis shock. He got bacterial poison from a dentist and went into a coma, and he has basically been recovering ever since. And this has been over 10 years ago. So I really feel for him because he does not look good at all.
They say sepsis is horrible, and hospitals downplay it a lot because it is so devastating. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, he basically got a bunch of bad bacteria poured in his mouth, and that is not good.
Yeah.
From a dentist.
And it'll eat you from the inside. Whew. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
And yeah.
I did want to mention that. I forgot to mention. We'll talk a little bit more about Barker too, because he is obviously the influence of this movie. However, the special effects in this movie are terrible. I alluded earlier that you couldn't do stop animation because it was too late, and you couldn't do CGI because it was too early. So the effects look like Highlander or The Keep or even Hellraiser for that matter. The effects look cheesy. The whole crackling electricity effect, I hate that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the fact is he, and I can't remember because I think I remember when we collectively watched this, you had told me about the novella or I found the novella or whatever. I remember reading the novella and thinking that the creatures had a lot more personality than in the movie.
Pelican,
and that's
especially
unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Except for Porcupine Girl, they didn't really have special abilities. They basically were animals and growled and jumped on people and threw people around or bit them or whatever. There wasn't special things that these mutations or these whatever that they had.
Or the Berserkers, which were their version of Cenobites, I guess. The Berserkers. Release the Berserkers.
the uncontrollable ones.
Yeah.
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 Sort of thing. But I think he probably spent $6 million of his 11 on just creatures.
On makeup. Yes. You can see it.
Yeah.
The makeup is the best thing in this movie. Yeah.
And the fact that it's so unique and very Barker. I can't. Other than certain, maybe some more modern Star Wars, like Andor, where they have a lot of alien species, do you see this amount of different physiology in makeup?
Yeah, it's a recurring theme in his works. I like it better in Hellraiser because, like I said, there's only a few Cenobites. It's small, and he can devote all his concentration on that little bit. This is very broad. His books are very broad. They read better than they translate. But Weave World, The Thief of Always, The Aberrat, they all feature these whole societies of different creatures because he's a painter. He paints them all. He's very imaginative. And it's a common theme, and this is where I'm leading to what the allegory of this movie is, and it's the fact that Barker was gay, and back then that was not an easy thing to be because gay people were still not thought of as highly. Producers expressed concern in this movie that the monsters were good, and he's like, that's the point.
Right.
That this whole movie serves as an allegory for intolerance. The monsters are outcast by society. They're deemed as dangerous by the, quote, normal people, which are basically serial killers, fanatical priests, and law enforcement.
Right.
Right. So, and it is an allegory at the time, really, when you think about it. You had the Jerry Falwells that were coming after the gay community. You had law enforcement coming after the gay community. You had everybody. This is a huge key that I'm already releasing, and I hate to do it, but it's what Universal Monsters were doing, too. It's the same thing.
Yep.
Exact same thing. Especially if you look at Bride of Frankenstein. But anyway, that's what this movie's about. It's about being the underdog.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that makes sense.
So he did have a vision. It just didn't come together, really. I can talk cast, or if you have some other things you want to say about it beforehand.
Well, normally we do scenes, and I think we'll be short because I don't think there's a lot that are good. I do like the opening. I think it's a very good hook. I think the credits are very unique and interesting, and it has a very intense opening, and we get to see a really good first kill kind of feel to it. That was a good scene. And I also like the scene between the what's Cronenberg's character's name? What's
Decker.
The killer's name? Decker. Mm-hmm. I do like the scene between him and the mechanic, I guess is what I call him, or the guy that owned the store. And it's almost like an interrogation scene with him where he's wanting to know more about Midian.
Yes.
And everything before he kills him. I thought that was one of the better scenes in this film, if you want, for lack of a better word.
One of the scenes that sticks out to me, and we talked about how the special effects weren't that great, but the miniatures are in this. Some of the miniatures are really cool. Like, first of all, you can't run through that cemetery without falling into the Midian anymore, because I guess the earthquake or the bomb going off, it has made everything very...
Yeah.
Volatile, for lack of better words. And there's one point where a truck is driving and it just does a nosedive. And it's going, and there's like these rope bridges and stuff down inside Midian. And you see this truck just come trucking down through that. And it's clearly a miniature, but it looked really cool, I thought.
Yeah, I've got in my notes, it seems like so many levels and so deep and everything else, and yet Midian is the most explosive underground city in the world.
Yeah. And it was like, man. Clive, what is the deal with blowing everything up? Even when they trap the nice monster guy with the little bulldog out in the sun and he starts burning like a vampire, he explodes.
Yeah. He explodes. Yeah, I'm going, okay, sure.
So you don't have to make everything explode for it to be a movie. Yeah, there's a lot of explosions in this movie. But you could tell he was reaching for the stars. He was trying to make a big budget movie on a small budget.
Yes. So. I think
he was. I think he was swinging for the, what's the cliche?
Swinging for the fences.
Swinging for the fences, yep. Exactly.
Yep.
And
I agree with
and
that.
And he did not have the knowledge of movie making. He had only done one movie, and he did not have the money you would need to do that as well, I don't think.
Was this shot in England? Because this one wasn't, right? This was in the U.S.
This was primarily in England and Canada.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Didn't know that. But they did a lot of reshoots in L.A. But a lot of it was at Pinewood. Yeah. Any other scenes before I move on?
I have none other listed.
I like scenes with Cronenberg in general because he's a very unique choice for that role. It's very underplayed.
Yes, but if you see him in anything, he underplays. Mm. You see him later in... What's the other one he's in, other than Star Trek Discovery? He's in Dead Ringers? No.
I don't
remember.
Something
else that I remember him from. And he always plays this very kind of understated, straightforward, non-smiling, I know more than you do sort of. Yeah, it's Dead Ringers where he plays he's an obstetrician.
He directed that. He starred in it too? Played in it too?
I thought he had a cameo.
Oh, you know what? Isn't he the doctor that delivers the baby in The Fly?
Yeah.
I think he is.
He's the one that delivers
so
the larva.
So maybe he did do a cameo in his own movie. That would make sense. Okay.
I thought so.
Yeah. I haven't seen Dead Ringers in 30 years, so I don't remember. But yeah, I do remember The Fly.
Yeah.
But anyway, Sheffer is... Well, all right, let's just go on to cast since we're talking... people in it. Sheffer, sure. I only know him other than this from the movie A River Runs Through It, which is really more of a Robert Redford, Brad Pitt vehicle than a Craig Sheffer, who's the guy that played Dallas in Alien, Tom Skerritt vehicle.
Tom Skerritt.
Yeah, because they're all in that movie. Well, Robert Redford directed it, didn't he, I think?
Yeah.
I will say he's exactly 5 years older than me. He was born on April 23rd, 1960.
Okay.
Other people were considered for this role, but they are much older, or at least one of them is. Do you have any thoughts or ideas? They are both 80s film people. I will tell you that.
80s film people?
Yeah.
No, I don't really. Well, I don't know. Would you use any of like
the 80s genre Corey film Feld, people?
Corey Feldman's or any of those?
No, they're older.
Oh, okay.
Rucker Hauer. Yeah, much okay. older. And much. Christopher Lambert, Highlander.
Oh. Yeah, much, much older than what we
Yeah, and here. I don't know if people know this, yeah. but he's really short. It would be funny to see him do it. Both were considered before Craig Sheffer got it. I don't really have any other information on that. I do know that he and Anne Bobby, who plays Laurie Winston in the movie, were both very good at getting out there and trying to promote it. They really wanted okay. this movie to be successful, and I think everyone did, except maybe David Cronenberg. He could care less.
Yeah, probably.
But anyway, Anne Bobby plays Laurie Winston. I don't really have anything on her. She really did sing that song, but I think it's obvious because it's terrible.
Yeah, and she has no mic technique whatsoever. I'm going, has this girl ever sung with a microphone before? What
I don't have a picture anyway. Of her. I'd post it. As we mentioned, Cronenberg plays Decker. I think he's inspired casting. However, Charles Hayde plays Captain Eigerman, which is the worst caricature I have seen in a film since I can remember.
See, and he is great in
Altered States.
The other one that I Altered States. Mm-hmm. I love his character in that, but he is terrible in this movie.
Yeah, I said
he is just.
I said NYPD Blue, and I meant ER. He was on ER. He's not a bad actor, but
no.
he just didn't have a director that could pull him back in this. He was.
Obviously.
Crazy, and I don't know.
He turned this. He might as well have been chasing Smokey.
Yeah.
In this.
That's exactly what it was. Bad. He was like Jackie Gleason. It was terrible.
Yes, it got that bad in the last half hour of this movie. It really did. So, yeah.
Speaking of Highlander, Hugh Quarshie played Detective Joyce. He's the African-American actor, and he was also in Highlander. Okay. He was also in The Phantom Menace. I'm not sure what he played in that. But all of these actors are pretty much still working these days if they're around. Hugh Ross played Narcisse. He's the one that cuts his face off, and he's kind of like the harbinger of Midian. He's the one that wants to go with Boone to Midian. He's heard about it too.
And see, that's a very, very, to me, that's a very, very Barker thing. Mm-hmm. And actually, David Cronenberg. Mm-hmm. That body horror of a mental patient is willing to literally cut his own face off in front of
yeah.
you sort of thing. That's a very cool horror moment.
He's also a very memorable character. People liked him, and then Barker killed him off. So the studio wanted him to bring him back, which is one of the reasons why there were different cuts of this movie. They also brought David Cronenberg's character back in one of the cuts, too. There is so much film of this movie that is not in it. I'm sure it's a jumbled mess. However, Hugh Ross was also in Patriot Games and Trainspotting. Another familiar face, Doug Bradley, plays Lyles Berg, who is kind of like the shaman of Midian. He is Pinhead himself from Hellraiser. He's an old friend of Barker's from theater troupes, and they have been working together for a long time. His voice was originally redubbed by an anonymous German actor. It was very much to Doug's annoyance. And when Barker redid the movie in whenever it was, the early 2000s, they went back and redubbed Doug's voice in and put it back.
Okay.
So Barker did correct a lot of things. The problem is it took a long time to get this. Once they found the footage, which was never really lost anyway, the studio just didn't want to do it because they didn't think it was worth it. When he finally got the power to make it happen, he changed a lot and added stuff. He even wanted to get Elfman back and do new music. And I was like, this guy's obsessed.
Yeah. Should have done it right the first time.
Right. True. So, yeah. Catherine Chevalier played Rachel, who is this woman here that reminds me of somebody. I can't put my finger on it.
Okay.
Malcolm Smith is the only actor that's last credit was in 1990, so he's one that's not working now. He's the one that played the fanatical priest that was transformed into kind of a bad guy at the end.
Yeah, which was unusual. That was a twist. I was going, really?
Yeah, he was rejected by Baphomet, and Boone was made the Jesus Christ of the Nightbreed or whatever. Oliver Parker played Pelequin. He is the character that bites Boone that eventually turns him into a monster. He's the one that looks like red with dreadlocks. Here he is right there. And
was that, let me ask you that plot point. So was that, because I don't remember it from the novella.
Me either. I haven't read it in a long time.
Was Boone always destined to become Cabal, or was the bite part of like a vampire sort of thing, or a zombie or whatever? You have to be bitten to transform. Or was it transform and then there was a prophecy that the priest of Baphomet was talking about? Is that what
I really don't remember the story. It's been a very long time since I read it. Saw the same version I saw, it ended with what looked like a cave painting telling the story. Did you see that?
Yep.
And he was the Jesus Christ or whatever, the chosen one, the savior of Midian. It was like it was foretold that he would come, Midian would fall, but that he would find their new haven or whatever. And that's the story.
Right. He would lead them to the promised land, exactly. Just like Moses.
Yeah, yeah, because the Bible is key in this. And I'm not joking. Yeah.
Well, that's where the Israelites went for the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
They dwelled in the land of Midian.
Right. Exactly. And Barker even says in that interview I sent that was supposedly his last interview, and he's still alive, but he's just not going to do more public appearances because of his health.
Of course.
He said that one of his biggest influences is the Bible, that he was constantly rewriting things from the Bible. Nicholas Vince played that moon face character in this picture there. You can't really see it front on, but he's got a crescent-shaped head.
Yep.
Always liked that makeup. I thought he was pretty cool. And then Simon Bamford came on to play Onaka. Onaka is the one I mentioned that had the little dog and ended up exploding.
Yeah, the one we're supposed to feel sorry for.
Yeah, he was originally supposed to be another actor. I can't remember who it is. It may be in my notes later. And that actor fell through, and he is another childhood friend of Barker's that Barker got on the phone and called. So Barker was always giving roles to old theater people that he was friends with.
Mm-hmm.
So
that, which is fine. That's good. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah. Nina Robertson plays Babette, which is another one of those Highlander effects that I just want to repress.
Yeah.
Christine McCorkindale has never acted in another film. She's the one that played Porcupine Girl that you were talking about.
Yeah, I don't think Babette did either. I don't think she's done anything.
Maybe not.
So, yeah.
And that's all I have there.
One Nightbreed was enough for them.
Yeah. Despite the fact that, and Tyree, please don't hold this against us. I haven't seen you in a few years. But we appreciate you recommending this movie. And I do respect it for what it attempted to be. However, as much as David and I have trashed this, it won a lot of awards.
Yeah, I could imagine that. Especially in 90 or 91.
Well, and it won a Blu-ray when it was released because of the fact that it was restored into its original form, a director's cut.
Okay.
So Barker also won the jury prize at the 1991 Avoyaz Fantastic Film Festival. I've mentioned this festival before. I think it's in France, maybe Spain. I can't remember, but it's specifically a genre film festival where they always are putting people up like Carpenter or somebody that's known for horror. So it doesn't surprise me that he won that prize. He also won several on the indie genre circuit. I'm not going to go into them all. However, it's not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die list.
No.
Which is no surprise. And that's really all I have as far as cast and awards. So
interesting.
But yeah, it did. It won a smattering of awards on the indie circuit. Not just the indie circuit, but the genre indie circuit, if that makes sense. Like that a voyage
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, because again, we can both see what he was trying to do, and we both love his first film, and we love his novellas and his short stories and his novels. I even like Weave World, and what was the other one? Dead Poet, Dead Letter Office, Dead Letter.
The Damnation Game.
No, he's got one that was really cool. That was about
The Great and Secret Show.
Maybe that's it.
The one with the mailbox. Yeah. It starts with the mailbox. Yeah.
Yeah, Dead Letter Office. Yeah, sort of thing. And yeah, I think there were other authors that have never been really translated into film well that I like better as horror writers than Clive Barker. One of those being, what's this guy that did Swan Song?
Oh, McCammon?
McCammon. I really like McCammon's works. And I don't think I remember them ever being turned into films.
I can't recall any.
Yeah. But so you got to commend it to Barker that he pushed hard enough or had enough clout or did it, was in the right place at the right time to get at least two films of his work made.
Well, and other people have adapted stuff that's fantastic. Candyman is fantastic. I don't know if you ever saw The Midnight Meat Train, but that is a pretty dark movie with Bradley Cooper in it before anyone knew who Bradley Cooper was.
I remember, I think you were the one that turned me on to Barker to begin with. And to me, he was the modern Lovecraft. He was very, to me, Lovecraftian. He always talked about demons and dark lords and things from the deep.
Yeah, but he kind of crossed over into less horror, more fantastical, and more children's oriented in some ways, too.
Yeah, I think he... He kind of like had his 80s where it was drug and sex excess and then went, I got to repent for this a little bit. Let's tell some kids stories.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Or whatever. But yeah, he always had some unique characters. That's why I think the compelling, saying that the monsters are the good guys in this is one thing to say, yeah, that's cool. But you don't like the heroes in this movie. And you care more about the villainous serial killer than you do about the hero. So I think there's a disconnect with how he personifies his heroes.
I agree.
If that makes sense.
I agree completely. I do think he is an acquired taste. Some of his books do kind of meander in these worlds, and I get lost. I haven't really read one of his books since The Great and Secret Show. And Weave World was a slog, but I liked it when I finally finished it.
Yeah, but you're right. It was much more fantasy than it was.
It was about somebody falling into a carpet.
Yeah.
And a whole world inside this carpet. Yeah, exactly. So it's very fairy tale-ish almost. I liked his books of blood. And that's what Stephen King said.
Oh, yeah.
This is the future of horror. And I agree. Some of those stories are amazing. And he's still working on trying to get them developed. Apparently, The Damnation Game is in development. That's his very first novel. I mentioned that he has fallen into poor health, and it's a shame because he was a nice-looking man. He was gay. I was kind of shocked at the time because there weren't a lot of out gay authors, and he was in my world, in the horror world, which made me even more happy. I met him with our friend Bill Pitts in 1995. We went to a convention, and I just pulled this down because I remembered I had it up on my desk. Can you see that? It's a little reflective, but that's a picture of me with him.
With the Clive
with
Barker.
Yeah, when he was still in good health and not, he doesn't even, he looks, I can't even describe what he looks like now. One of his teeth is missing. His face is all gone. You wouldn't even recognize him. You should watch that interview I sent you, though, because he is still bright and very communicative. And it's a great interview. But when you see him, it's kind of shocking.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. But so it was great. Anyway, keys?
Keys. There's some, obviously, the first key you've already mentioned was the original novella that it's based on. Of course, that inspired this movie, and that's what he took it from. I've got Lovecraft in general, just because the whole thing of a cemetery hiding these mutant creatures that have been around for thousands of years and are homeless and all of that is very, to me, an ancient evil kind of, which I always associate with Lovecraft. And also these haunted places being accessible. I even have in my notes, so we can just jump into a car and drive to the mythical monster city? Really? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It's just under the cemetery.
It's just under the cemetery. It's right over there. Take a left past the old guy with the lights wrapped around him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
My first key, well, like you said, other than the book, is I mentioned Universal horror movies. He's clearly trying to make you sympathetic for the monster. And movies in particular that did that are Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, The Wolfman, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and the list goes on. I love that trope, and I recognize it as a recurring trope in horror cinema. And that's why I don't want to totally trash this film, because I do think it has its place, if that makes sense.
Well, and I've got one around the same era, which is Freaks.
Yes, yes.
Todd Browning's Freaks. That, again, we're making them the heroes of this.
That may be it's Universal. The, I can't remember.
It's the normal people that are the mean ones in it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what this is saying, down to the fact that he really loses it in that last act, but the incompetence of the police and the way they are just brutally destroying these poor people turns into me, unfortunately, first blood. The whole scene before that at the cop, at the police station, everything, it's first blood. So I was going, okay, so we were influenced by Sylvester Stallone too. So,
yeah, yeah, it would have come out first, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mentioned that it spawned a comic book. And that comic book had 25 issues, so I would say it probably went beyond this story, would be my guess.
Probably, I would think.
But it also spawned a graphic novel that was called Hellraiser versus Nightbreed, Jihad, which merges both worlds and features the Cenobites as agents of an order against the chaotic nemesis of the Nightbreed. And the Jihad, which is a holy war, is the extermination that the first wages on the latter. So,
Cenobites. Now, did Barker write those?
It wouldn't surprise me if he said, hey, I got this idea, and then let someone else write it. I don't know. I don't know if he wrote it or not, though.
I wondered when I watched this if Buffy was influenced by this, just because this dude is very David Boreanaz sort of light. And takes place in a it's a cemetery with monsters and demons, but they're all nice. Some of them are nice and good, which is what Buffy talked about a lot.
Yeah, the whole world of monsters living amongst us, and some of them being good, some of them being bad. Yeah,
right. And Buffy came out almost a decade later.
Not even that long. This came out in 90, Buffy was late 90s, wasn't it? Mid-90s?
97.
Yeah.
I think 97 or 98 was Buffy. The movie came out in 94, but it doesn't count because it's
something. No, but it's on our list.
But yeah, I've got in my notes, this guy is either Jeff Conway or David Boreanaz light.
I don't think he looks like Jeff Conway at all.
I think it's the hairstyle that reminds
me. The mullet?
That kind of mullet blown on top look, 80s look.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Unfortunate.
He reminds me of someone else, but I can't remember who it is. It's another actor from that time. But
I've got – it's kind of a weird stretch to me, but and I don't know if it influenced or not, but it may have. But Crash, which is the film that Cronenberg did later on about the car fetish. Because it has that same kind of – underfeel to this of a taboo kind of fetish, whether it's loving monsters or serial killing or whatever. That it just gave me that kind of vibe when I was watching it.
Well, I don't know if you noticed, but that most of the monsters have tattoos and piercings, or they're wearing leather and studs, which is all very, very gay, but now more mainstream. But at the time, it was more gay subculture. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that you say that. I've got this is stuff I pulled off the internet. There were two video games also produced.
Wow.
One of them, well, there were two. There was supposed to be a third, but it was never produced because the first two didn't do well. One was for the Amiga, Atari, ST. It just lists all the places. And it's called Clive Barker's Nightbreed, the interactive movie.
Okay.
I don't know what the other one's called. So anyway, I'm not a gamer, so sorry, folks. I don't know. All that's like a foreign language to me.
I've got, and especially the poster that you see a lot, not the one that just has the girl's eye kind of poster, but the other one that has like, there are several posters based on all of your iterations of the edits of this movie, but the one that looks like, oh, we're a gang, not a club kind of thing, sort of attitude with him in the center and then all the monsters around him and Laurie on his side and all that. It's very Lost Boys.
Okay.
And I got a big Lost Boys kind of feel from it looking
it's
at it.
It's only three. Okay, it was like 2 years later, I think. Yeah.
I said I could totally see that being an influence on Lost Boys.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lost Boys influenced it.
And then I have Pan's Labyrinth. I have Pan's Labyrinth because I think that Del Toro was influenced by this because, again, you've got the story of the fantasy, quote, world, Midian and or the underground in Labyrinth with the monster guy and all of them. But the monsters are ambiguous. We don't know if they're good, bad, and we kind of go back and forth. But the real monsters, villains, awful, are the Nazi that is killing people and threatening the family and all that on top. And I think that I wonder if Barker watched Pan's Labyrinth and went, that's exactly what I was trying to do.
I know it is.
That's it, right?
It is, except he has a Liverpudlian accent. But yeah, sounds like a beetle when he talks.
Right. He's very down.
Yeah. That's exactly what I thought. I was like, wow. Del Toro came along at the right time when he knew he could make this work. And he does create worlds. But one of the reasons I liked Pan's Labyrinth is it's a small world. You don't see a lot of creatures, so it's a little bit more concentrated, and I like that better than the whole Cecil B. DeMille action film or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You can tell a much scarier and moody story with one or two monsters than you can with 16 that you're having to give airtime to, and you're having to give backstories to, and you're having to, or you don't, like this one does, and just, oh, we all look at this scene and go, aren't those cool monsters in the background?
Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned Pan's Labyrinth, but I just had Del Toro in general as a key. It's like Barker was trying to do what Del Toro is now achieving, even with The Shape of Water, which is just a single monster. It's still the same story. It's the universal story of the monster is the good guy and the scientist is the bad guy. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Same thing.
So true. So true. That's definitely the thematics under this.
I have that Cronenberg's character's name is Dr. Philip K. Decker. Which is a reference not so subtle to the author, Philip K. Dick.
Yep.
Who, we know.
Whose character Deckard was in
Blade Runner. Was the lead character in Blade Runner. I was going to mention that. That's kind of coincidental, I think. But maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe they did do it. Maybe they did try to just combine the names. Philip K. Deckard.
I do not know.
I don't know. Rachel's rescue of Boone by the nude seduction of the prison guard is an homage to Toby Hooper's similarly maligned and spectacular Life Force. which, and I put Life Force down for this reason. Apparently, it was also the victim of near-fatal studio interference 5 years prior to this. And we wanted that movie to be great because it's based on book called Space Vampires. And it's right up our alley. And we go to see that movie, and it was a slog, man. That was the worst fucking movie. And now I want to go find like a re-edited version. I wonder if they've re-put that, like fixed it.
And who is it? Railsback?
Railsback's in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great effects too. Great makeup, I should say.
Yeah, it had good makeup. It had a very attractive female. It had
she was always weightlessness naked.
And space stuff. But yeah, so there you go.
So yeah, I would put Life Force as a similarity in keys that way. I don't have anything else except a little trivia I forgot to mention. Do you have any other keys?
I do not have any other keys. I did have one just a mention, not even trivia. Image Animation was the company credited with doing the makeup for this movie.
Yeah.
And I think they need to be recognized.
They should.
I do think the makeup is very strong.
It's the star of the movie. I mean, it really is.
Yeah. Well, or Deckard's mask, because that is a great design.
Yeah. It's a creepy-ass mask.
A creepy-ass mask.
I don't know how he could see in it with those buttons for eyes, but yeah.
That works for me.
Okay. This is actually a good segue since we're running out of keys and I'm going to do this little thing. Morgan Creek reportedly began developing a television series based on the original film in 2014. In the following year, they announced the sale of the domestic rights to its library of 78 films, but the production company plans to retain the TV rights to Nightbreed. In June of 2018, Sci-Fi, Morgan Creek, and Barker teamed up to develop the series. It's being written by Josh Stolberg and directed by Michael Dougherty for SF. Sci-Fi. Not a great platform. But
I always go back and say The Expanse came from Sci-Fi, too.
Didn't Battlestar Galactica come from there, too? Did Battlestar come from there?
I don't think so, but that may be true. I'm going to have to look that one up.
Anyway, I would love to see it happen, and I would love to see somebody with the capability of someone like Del Toro to try to develop it and make it happen, but we'll see. Del Toro should jump on it.
Yeah, because a series would allow us to know more of these denizens of Midian kind of thing and explore it more. That would be interesting. And you could even combine it with a jihad. And the end of season one, you see Pinhead.
Here comes Pinhead. I want to see like a WandaVision version of Pinhead. Like, here comes Pinhead. And it's like a situation comedy.
There you go.
Have you seen my lament configuration?
You left it by the poodle.
The poodle.
Oh, folks, we are so glad that we are back doing what we love and doing this. And again, this was a listener request, and we hope you enjoyed our take on it. We would love for you now to respond and let us know. Why did you ask us to look at this movie? Because we both love Clive Barker and we wished this was better? Or
Tyree has good taste. Like, I do remember that.
Okay, so Tyree's good. Tyree, get in touch with us. Anybody else, what do you guys think? If you liked it or didn't like it, we'd love to hear from you. We're always open to email. You can leave us a note down below in all the comments. Please subscribe, ring the bell, do all of the wonderful things that we have to do. If you like what you've seen, go back and find another movie. We've got a plethora on the YouTube site and the podcast channel of previous films. We even have a deep dive way back in season one of Haunting of Hill House. I think we did every episode.
The Haunting of Hill House. Yeah.
Yeah.
We did. We did 10 episodes on that, but it's all audio. Yeah. It's not video. Yeah.
Correct. All audio. But so if you like podcasts, go back and listen to that. And we also have a Patreon. If you would like to support us and help us continue doing this moving forward, almost everybody and their brother has a podcast now, but not everybody has Patreon and has support that we can garner from you guys. And we have free material there as well as some tiered material, some additional podcasts like the Dilithium Chamber, where we examine Star Trek, the original series, and X-Files Declassified, where we dive into scary sci-fi and combo in X-Files. So if you like that, join us. Tim, I think next week we might be somewhere else, maybe.
We're going a little further back and into outer space.
Yay, I like outer space. I want to
do
that.
But it's 70s, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh. That could be bad.
No,
we'll see.
It'll be good.
We'll see. But yes, join us next week and when we dive further into a different influential film.
Okie doke. So I will see you then.
I'll see you then.
All right, bye.
Bye.